Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Philip Sage from ARMS Reliability in Australia.
Hey, Philip. Well, I understand, and you mentioned Australia, so not only is it you're a day ahead of me when we're recording this, it's your Friday, so you're so lucky. You're at the, as you were mentioning before we started, you're on your tail end of your week. And so you got any plans for the weekend?
Possibly. I've got a couple SUP stand-up paddle boards on the top of the car at the moment, and we live close to the ocean, so getting on the water or a baseball practice. We still play baseball avidly in the elder ages in Australia. Oh, yeah. So it's quite a open opportunity of what to do this weekend.
Oh wow, good for you! No. See, I'm going into. I have some sourdough leaven on the shelf right now, and it's percolating away, and tomorrow I'll be baking sourdough artisan bread. One of the things I've learned in baking my own bread, which from what I understand, it's become quite popular as people are staying home more often, although paddleboarding sounds a whole lot more fun and better exercise. I found that if I just follow the recipe, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And the more I read and the more I study how to bake a good loaf of artisan craft bread kind of thing, I realize how little I know about how to bake bread. I got one book today, is considered a classic from a few years ago. And the first 150 pages are a detailed description of all the steps to bake one loaf of bread.
Wow.
It goes into amazing detail, but it goes into things like, well, how do you know when it's risen enough? You know, and how do you test it? How do you monitor it? What's going on that's happening? How does temperature affect it? How does the humidity affect it? What's the type of wheat you're using? How does that change it? How do you evaluate and understand whether you got it ready or not to go on to the next step? I was just looking at the clock. The process said this takes 4 hours, 4 hours. I went on to the next step. It's becoming clear to me as the more I understand that process and the chemistry, essentially, of what's going on, the clock was just a guideline. And, you know, there's a parallel here to our world in reliability, whether it's a maintenance tech torquing down bolts, he may follow the process, but not understand that he just broke off three of these, you know, or fractured them or did something that wasn't right, but not being aware of it, he wouldn't even know that he did it. Or, sitting down with a pile of data and shoving it into a computer and I get a beautiful plot out of it. And the analyst, she might not know that it's doesn't mean anything because of missing one step in the process or not understanding the nuances, the data set that she had. So I don't know. You've learned stuff. I mean, you learned stand-up paddleboarding. I don't think it's like riding a bike. You got to practice and get to know it and get the feel. And you know, I imagine. And baseball is definitely not a subtle sport. Well, it's not rugby, I should say.
Yeah, no, it's not rugby.
But, I mean, do you see anything like that in as you wander around our discipline?
I see it all the time, and I actually see it from a course in the new reliability engineers that want to work with the software of the day that's flashy and glitzy and effectively become software jockeys. And I also see it in the very experienced people, but unfortunately, when you work with them, you find out that they don't really understand what they're doing. And you know, as you mentioned with bread, we have a couple of batches of moldy pickles, so we're kind of on that innocence to awareness, learning journey in the pickle making business, and we're going to have to throw these batches out and start all over because we obviously don't know what we're doing, and we could use a great mentor to help us with the recipe, but we're trying. And I think that's where A lot of reliability engineers find themselves as they're faced with a new challenge. It's not something that you've been taught in school. I think, Fred, would you say that's correct?
Well, I certainly didn't learn it. Although I didn't learn reliability engineering in school. I mean, I've been to conferences and taken a few seminars and things like that. One of the classes I had in college was is physics class. And the professor insisted that we always guess first. You read the problem, write down your answer. Don't even think about it. Just order of magnitude is good enough kind of thing. And or directional or whatever the nature of the question was, he says, guess. And he said, because otherwise you're going to go through the calculations, you're going to do all this other stuff, and then you have no basis of which to compare that. You need to trust your instinct of what, you know, this should be a big result or it should be a small number or something like that. And then if you do all the calculations and you're two orders of magnitude off, unless you check yourself, you don't even know. You wouldn't know. And so it kind of instilled in me is to never trust my work, which in his class turned out to be pretty accurate. My guesses were often much closer to the true answer than anything I calculated. But be that as it may. But it gave me a healthy skepticism of an answer. If I could do something with like two different methods or two different approaches, or have somebody check my work and they get the same or similar results, then I trust what I'm doing. But I think it came from that physics class way back when.
Yeah, physics is in my blood, I guess, is probably one of the hidden secrets about me. Back in my formal training days at uni, I was awarded 2 degrees in physics and one in electrical engineering. So very familiar with the physics field. And it does teach you a new way of thinking to kind of broaden your horizons and start with the basics. And you mentioned a process of starting with your best guess is having something that's fundamentally reasonable for what you would expect the answer to be. And then doing the calculation is a good way to have something to check against, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No wonder I like you, Philip. And I have electrical engineering was my primary of my degree, but I had a minor or a major, I guess, a double major in physics. So we approach the world a similar sort of weird way, I guess. But you're exactly right. Now, the other thing that came out of that class is you have to understand that your first guess is just a guess. And sometimes your calculation's dead on and it may be surprising. And so that skepticism is not to self-doubt, right? It's to have a basis for checking. And I think it extends to, especially when we're doing product testing, for example, where we're starting up a line and keeping our fingers crossed that it would work, is being willing to be surprised, right? And then learn something from that. And so it's a different way to think through these problems. The real hurdle I see is, and I've seen it with colleagues, is let me see that. And they tally up the numbers and they get a number that's obviously impossible. I actually saw this once in a legal case. I was an expert witness in a case and asked to review some data. And the analyst was looking at field failure data and calculated a 3-parameter Weibull that had a negative, gamma, the location parameter,
right,
was negative. And I explained to the lawyer, I said, you know, just I don't have to do a lot of analysis. Let's save a lot of time. That's just impossible. You're saying it failed 2 months before the product was manufactured.
We need a reality check here, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. Some people call it a sniff test or a gut check or things like that. But why is that lacking? Why isn't that just taught somewhere? You know,
I think underlying there's so much faith in the computers these days, and maybe I'm missing the true point or the root cause. But I think that's a contributing factor, and everybody's willing to be a keyboard jockey for whatever program you're running to process the data. And when you get a result, you believe that it has to be right, but there's no reason that it can be right in some cases, and it's impossible in the physical world to achieve. So you know your point is very well taken. Do you have another example?
I'm trying to think of the negative, failures occurring before it's created was my favorite one by far. I'm trying to think of another salient one.
Yeah. Well, while you're thinking, I'll just throw in my recent encounter in the utility business, in the electrical distribution business. There's often the wooden power pole is pretty common around the world, while there are cement and steel and some other composites being used and introduced into the industry as a whole. It's relied on wooden power poles back into the even the 1800s on the telegraph systems that were used. And when you collect data, I've seen quite a few cases where the wooden power pole in practical terms usually has a lifespan of about 70 years, depending on the species and the type of soil it's set into in the region and whether or not termites are prone to the area and a variety of different fungi. But it has an end of life generally in the 70 to 80 year range, or sometimes as low as 60 years, depending on the durability class of the wood. And the problem that I've seen recently that seems to date back 15 or 20 years through some very good reliability engineers is that they're forecasting, when they add in their failure data and suspensions, that the poles will last 125 years. Do you think that's right?
No, I don't think that's right. I know there's some variability. You mentioned some of it, but it was like typically 70 years. So I'm making the assumption that it's, 40. There's going to be the ones that get hit by a car and fall over, hit by lightning and shatter. And then there's going to be the ones that, it's classic wear out, like you were talking about fungus and all this stuff. But I'm thinking on that lower edge and the moist termite ridden areas are like 40 years. And then the bulk of the population, 70 years. And a few of them might go out to 80, 90 years. And if you get really lucky, you got one in a high, dry desert that gets no thermal cycling and no bugs, and it'll last maybe 100 years. But I'm just guessing at the variability of this.
Yeah. Well, all good guesses. And the interesting thing is that when you render an impossible result for the practical world, it seems to be accepted because it's been calculated by software, and the underlying knowledge or the theory of what you're doing is being dismissed as something that doesn't need to be considered.
I just thought of the example, and then it might explain this person, the example you have. If they're calculating 125-year MTBF value and believe that's a duration, then they have two problems. But
yes, they do.
Now, if you would have in 125 years, and I don't know, I haven't really looked at the life of telephone poles, and I know you have, but it seems on the edge of plausible. If the mean or expected value is around 70 or so years, there's going to be variation around that. Yeah, one of them, I think there's one in my neighborhood that's probably close to 100 years old. But I don't know, right? Whereas if you're looking at your entire data set and all of the suspensions, and if you have reasonable data, and it just makes sense that if I got a result that's that, is that, and you're calculating the median time or something like that? Is that what they're saying on the 125? Is that how long they should last?
Well, what they're calculating is a two or three parameter Weibull regression from the failure data with a large group of suspensions, which biases the calculation. The underlying theory, which you are probably aware of, is the application of the mean order number when you throw suspensions into the mix of your failure data. And the mean order number basically says that the combinatorial location or the rank of that suspension is best placed at the average. And that's effectively an educated guess. And when you have a lot of suspensions and not a lot of failure data as happens in the utility business. It ends up introducing a lot of statistical bias into the answer. And if you don't actually plot out the parameterized view and then back calculate when 99% or when 80% of the items will fail by from that parameterization, then you don't realize that you've just forecasted and predicted that, that these poles will last an extra 30 or 40 years, which they in practice don't do in that particular region.
And that's where that sniff test comes in, you know, and I've seen that in practice where a vendor comes in and says, oh, we got these great bearings that'll last 600 years. And my manager's like, well, I'm not paying extra for that. I only need it the last 5 years. And then we overhaul the line. And he goes, you don't understand. It's like, you don't have to take them off. You can use do go on in like 600 years. How in the world do you know that? You know, and it's like,
There's no way to know that. And even a related topic would be when you sit down to do a RAM study and you get data from the vendor that says that their asset or their piece of equipment lasts has a mean time to failure of 400 years. You start scratching your head a little bit and saying, where did that come from and what does that really mean?
Yeah, well, that was the subject of my webinar earlier this week when we're recording the week I did that webinar. And my intent was to say, well, what do you do when somebody either puts in contract or requests an MTBF value? And so the opening of the webinar was basically, well, here's why it's bad. Here's why it's misunderstood. Here's why it gives you such lack of information, blah, blah, blah. And I ended up with so many questions and challenges to that and stopping and having to go back. And I'm like, these are my peers. What's going on here? Maybe I should talk about this more often. But it was one person said it was a revelation to them when you go the reliability value of, say, 1 year. And if you assume it's an exponential distribution, if you're only given MTBF, I'll just do one quick example is. And I led into this, the reliability of e to the negative one, right? If you take the equal amount of time, the duration that you're interested in is equal to your MTBF value, it's e to the negative one. And you get 37% are expected to survive that 1 year, meaning two thirds have failed. And where it came in practice, in my world, was I was working with a company, and they were using MTBF, and they wanted to advertise it because it was like what you were saying, Phil, like 400 years. And I said, well, if you actually do the math for that, for the duration of what your product is supposed to do, you're saying you're going to have all these failures. And then I'm making up the numbers here to protect the person, because they didn't have all that good of a product, even over a year. And I said, well, your reliability is 37% for 1 year or something similar to that. And they looked at me and says, well, that sounds really bad. I says, well, that's what you're doing. That's what you're accomplishing. Here's the data. Here's the set. Here's why your customers are complaining so much that it's not working. And he says, well, we really like it when we say we have 10,000 hour MTBF for a year. And I'm like, okay. I don't know how to get past this one. The marketing have beat me to this one. Yeah. But anyway, I digress. So back to this notion of, you know, the keyboard jockey or the part is, and I've done it where I push the wrong button on a calculator and I get an answer. And it was that physics professor that said, wait a second, I should have two orders of magnitude in this answer. This number should be bigger than this. I must have done something wrong. And I try it again. And it's that there's that piece that's what I'm learning with the bread making is that I don't know enough about what's actually happening in the dough and through the various steps of the process. And as the more I understand it, the more scary it gets that I'll ever make a good loaf of bread. But I think that's where universities are teaching us how to use the software, but they don't teach us how where this came from. What was the algorithms used in it, or what's the theory of operation? And I've seen that in better facilities, is they teach the theory of operation first, and then they let the team loose on the equipment. But it's, I don't see that in the analyst world at near as much or at all anymore.
Yeah, I think understanding what the theory, and it's difficult because most of the leading softwares that I'm aware of kind of disguise the theory that's being applied underneath, even in their help files. They're less than helpful. Mm-hmm. You have to do a lot of independent digging and reverse engineering to try and figure out what they're actually doing. But I think, when you start out in the reliability analysis field, learning and, being a reliability jockey or a software jockey is a good place to start, but it's not where you want to stay. And you want to continue to understand what it is that you're doing and the nuances. As you mentioned earlier, the exponential distribution, a lot of myths about that also to fully understand when and how and where that can be applied. So I think, using a two-parameter Weibull probably gets abused today by reliability engineers. I think that starting as a software jockey is a good place to start. It gives you a chance to gain some experience, but it should only be underneath a strong mentor. And the goal should be to transition you from the jockey to being the trainer, to understanding why a horse runs so fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, well put. Good summary. And it's, I think it goes back to what we talked about in our last episode, is you got to be willing to learn, and it's never ending. And as you run into new circumstances, I suggest challenge your assumptions, understand the nuances of when and why different things go out. But it's probably a subject to a whole nother discussion, is how to pick the right tools and which approach to take in a particular mode, and or when to know when to ask a question. It's an interesting phenomena. And
yeah, I agree. It's an interesting phenomena. It's definitely out there all around the world, and we can solve it by having better awareness of what the actual underlying theory is. And that's probably best done by strong mentorship by some experienced engineers that understand the underlying theory, to help the younger engineers come along and also gain that understanding.
Yeah. And I, one last note, Philip, I would say, and don't always just trust the shiny machine or your calculator. There's plenty of circumstances where it'll give you a beautiful number to 10 digits and be completely wrong. And I've experienced that. I've learned this the hard way a few times. I had an activation energy of 68 one time. Not even a decimal point in there. It was just 68. And a polite chemist told me that's really not going to happen. So I said, okay, all right, so back to the board. So anyway, I'm sure our listeners have run into some of this. And hopefully, if you're in this realm, if you're getting into your career, or you're in areas that you're just following the formula, hopefully you have that attitude of, well, I need to learn and be aware of the biases I bring to this stuff, or be cautious of what this equipment we have around us is telling us. I just thought of another example that you told me about, is if your thermometer is giving you a reading of 8,000 Celsius, but you can touch it with your hand and it's no problem, it's probably a bad sensor.
Probably.
Or you're on the wrong scale or something like that. But things like that, you just got to have a good nose about it. So, if there's any other examples out there, and if our listeners could, if you think of any like that, or one comes to your mind and you want to share a good story with us, we'd love it. Send it over to, or head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there you can find contact forms. You can get in touch with us. You can find Philip and I on LinkedIn or on our about pages on Ascendo Reliability. We certainly do enjoy hearing from you. It provides many of the topics that we talk about. And also, we'll get right back in touch with you as soon as we can with an answer or response. So please join the conversation. So with that, Philip, I think I'll get out of the way so you can head off to go do some paddleboarding.
Yeah, I've got it's Friday morning here, so I've got to work from home is the first task, and then high tide will be later this afternoon. So I'll probably knock off for a little bit and go enjoy a paddle and get some exercise. So, Fred, always a pleasure. Look forward to those questions from our listeners, and let you tie the bow and finish it out.
All right. Thanks, Phil. Well, that does it. And we'll talk to you later. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.